Dee Kelly. It's our first today at last February sitting. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will not be participating. Richard J. Weber, counsel for the Kellys. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Richard Weber, the law firm of Kelly Weber, Peets & Slater in Wausau. I'm here representing the defendants in this matter, John W. Kelly, and his son, Peter Kelly. This case originally started out with Joel Kelly, another son, being a party to the action, but he was dismissed. The trial court in this case in Oneida County granted summary judgment, finding violations of Section 30.12, paren 1A, and 30.15, 1A and D of the Wisconsin statutes. Essentially, those statutes provide that you can't fill a bed of a navigable stream or you can't obstruct navigable waters. This case, and I think we have to go a little bit into the facts. I'm sure the briefs will be more specific, but essentially the Kelly Dam on the Little Rice River in western Oneida County was overflowed. Overflowed hay meadows, which at one time were owned by John W. Kelly's grandfather. The lands were deeded to John Kelly, the defendant in this case, in 1986. John Kelly then gave to his sons Pete and Joe the lands which are the subject of this proceeding. And prior to that time, and in all the years, even prior to the construction of the dam on the Little Rice River, there were road accesses out to what is known as Pete's Point. The state likes to characterize Pete's Point as an island. Basically, it's a peninsula that meanders around, and Pete's Point is a high area, which is very nice. And in fact, Pete Kelly recently had constructed a home on there, and the home is under construction as the case proceeded. On April 17th of 1959, there was a... Excuse me.
Is the issue whether he gets there by road or by boat?
That's basically it, Your Honor. The road, which was out onto Pete's Point, had been there for years and years, even prior to the construction of the dam. In fact, when the water, when the DNR ordered, started this action, the court ordered the removal of the fill material, which was put in 1988, the original fill was removed, and that didn't satisfy the DNR, so additional material was removed, consisting of the old corduroy. In the old days, they constructed roads with logs, and this road out onto Pete's Point had old corduroy underneath it to reach the point. And when they removed it, they removed the corduroy and also some of the underlying soils, which were black dirt and stumps and so forth. So the road had been there for many, many years.
If you prevail, then what are you going to do, build a road?
We'd like the road restored. The road was...
You're going to fill?
We'd like to put the fill back where it was, Your Honor.
How many feet or yards or miles are we talking about?
Well, the original, in 1988, there was enough fill put in so that the roads wouldn't be flooded over from time to time because of the erratic manner in which the dam was being operated. So we'd have to put back the materials that were taken out, which consisted of not only the old corduroy, but also the fill material that was put in.
How wide is this going to be? How long is it going to be, and how deep is it going to be?
The road itself is approximately, there's two sections of the westerlymost road. The first section is about 40 feet long and probably not more than 15 or 20 feet wide. Then there's a 200-foot section which leads out onto the point. The first 40-foot section, the court couldn't find that there was any violation. At least there was no finding as such on the summary judgment motion. But the 200-foot section contained parts of areas where the court found, as a matter of law in the summary judgment motion, that it was below the ordinary high water mark. So there's portions of that 200-foot section which would, if we were allowed to put that back in, well, the whole 200-foot section would be replaced.
Now, your argument is basically they shouldn't have done summary judgment because there were material facts that were not discussed, and they're an issue, but the trial court just granted judgment, and he didn't look at the evidence in the light most favorable. So my question is basically, as I read these facts, and I must say that they're kind of confusing, but I'll try to put my best spin on what I think one of the allegations, one of the concerns is that this dam, which is a operated by raising and lowering these wooden planks, that it consistently or at times was raised beyond what the mark was indicated when it was first established. And I know that you go into that there was some possible fraud or forgery as to the mark, but basically the operation of the dam is what you're concerned about. If the ordinary high water mark, say, was 112, as I read your brief and understand this, you felt there was no problem. When it goes higher, then it causes the so-called flooding or rising beyond what you think is the ordinary high water mark. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's an issue of fact. The other issue here, of course...
And that issue of fact is what you're saying created, there was a material issue of fact that the trial court did not look at.
Trial court not only did not look at that, but we think that the evidence will be undisputed if we're permitted to present it, that at 112.0, all of the roads which went out to Feet's Point would be below the ordinary high water mark.
Well, wasn't that evidence presented, and why didn't you present it at the trial level?
Trial court, initially, Judge, we were at the courthouse in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. The judge said, well, many of these issues could be resolved by summary judgment. One of the issues, of course, was whether or not the permit itself, the dam permit, mandated the water level to be at 112.0. And we thought, as a matter of law, the court should have found that. The court did not find that and felt that that properties that are inundated by water, even though the permit says 112, would be acquired by the state by prescriptive rights. The other aspect was that the DNR took the position that the permit itself did not mandate a water level at 112 because the order establishing the permit didn't specifically say 112.0 as the pond level, although the conclusions in the hearing, which was held when the dam was established, said that the pond level should be maintained at 112.0. And that's an interesting point because while a DNR has taken the position during this trial that the permit didn't mandate a 112.0 pond, there were three memos, internal memos, that were circulated among the DNR personnel, which are attached to the Statement of Undisputed Facts. One of those memos is dated October 20th of 1994 and is from one Meg Galloway of the department to Mr. Dale Lang. And Dale Lang was the District Water Regulation and Zoning Superintendent in charge of the Rhinelander office. And the subject of that memo, which was an email, says Kelly Dam water levels. And she says, I just received a phone call from a very irate Dave Stefke, chairman of the town of Little Rice. It seems that the water level conflicts up there persist, and he's catching a lot of grief. After venting for a long period of time, he indicated he wanted our help to settle the problem.
I hate to interrupt you, but I have to, because I'm not sure that's the snake closest to you. You know, you always kill the snake that's closest to you. That's my theory in life. It seems to me that the snake closest to you, the initial obstacle that you have to overcome is whether or not, regardless of what the ordinary high water mark is, once a body of water, or once an area becomes navigable under the definition of the statute in the case law, the riparian owner loses rights to construct on it. I think that's the position of the state. And it seems to me that you have to convince us that you retained rights to build on land regardless of whether it became navigable or not. And then, of course, then the next argument is, then if you survive that obstacle, then you can make your factual arguments that, you know, it was 112 and it was the action of the state that made it rise. But isn't that the legal issue that we're faced with in this case?
Sure, I think that's right, Justice Babish, but the appellate court says it doesn't matter whether or not the ordinary high water mark is exceeded. Right. If, in fact, the water flows up onto somebody's land, doesn't matter how it gets there,
right,
whether it's because of some guy doing violence to the permit or putting too many boards in the dam or not paying attention to the dam operation, that once the water gets there, then the state takes jurisdiction, it has rights over that water.
Right.
We don't think that can be the law.
Well, that's what I think you should be arguing to us, because there really is not satisfactory law, at least for whatever reason we took this case, it seems to me that that's one possible reason that we took it, to determine whether or not a riparian owner retains the rights to construct on land that has, for whatever reason, suddenly become navigable.
And we think, Justice, the cases, State versus Trudeau is one that comes to mind, where they say that we have distinguished between state-owned lake beds and the uplands capable of private ownership. And there's a footnote in that case, footnote number 5 at page 102, that says uplands are lands bordering bodies of water, but above the high water mark. They go on to say the public interest in and title to the navigable waters in this state attaches to more than the open and perpetually navigable waters contained in lakes, rivers, and streams. It extends to areas covered with aquatic vegetation within the ordinary high water mark of the body of water in question. Diana Shooting Club is another case where they say at page 272, and that's reported at 156 Wisconsin 261, where the court held that hunting on navigable waters is lawful when it is confined strictly to such waters while they are in a navigable stage and between the boundaries of ordinary high water marks. There are several other cases that go on to say the same thing. They are specifically...
Well, Counsel, let me restate it another way. Let me state what I think is your position. You tell me if I'm wrong. I think that you are saying that you are entitled to deposit fill anywhere on the Kelly land that is above the ordinary high water mark, even if that land became submerged occasionally.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And I'm saying that the ordinary high water mark prescribes the limits of the state's jurisdiction. I'm saying that when the ordinary high water mark is exceeded, and a guy might float by in a boat, that's one thing, but as soon as it goes down again, I can use that water or that land any way I want, because the ordinary high water mark circumscribes the limits of the state's jurisdiction.
Okay.
And I think these cases that I mentioned, among others, would be the Willow versus Wade, Munch versus Public Service Commission, State versus Trudeau, Houselick versus DNR. I think most of those cases would support that conclusion.
Mr. Weber, what do you say the ordinary high water mark is here?
The ordinary high water mark, when the fill was placed in 1988, was not determined. The high water mark was not determined by the DNR until more than a year and a half later in 1990.
And so, in 1990, it was determined at 113.5?
That's correct.
Right, and you're saying that's not correct?
We're saying at that time that could be correct. The high water mark
changed in the year and a half period?
Sure, because Dale Lang, who was the water regulator in the zoning person up at the DNR in Rhinelander testified that ordinary high water marks can be established in as little as 6 months, or it could be 6 years, and there's no showing in the record as to when that high water mark was established. Given the fact that we have the erratic operation of that dam, which started back in the 1980s, there are people on that lake, and these memos would support that I was reading to the court, the controversy that existed. One guy wanted the water high, one guy wanted the water low. The man that operated the dam said he never got any direction as to how he should operate the dam. He said, well, I would just pull boards out when I felt that the dam was in danger. At one time, the water got so high that the earthen portion of the dam was starting to erode away. And this was in 1993. So there was no control over the dam.
Well, at the summary judgment hearing, did you offer any affidavits or any documentary evidence as to what you believe the high water mark was in 1988?
All we said was that if the water had been maintained at 112.0 as the permit required, the roads would be far above the ordinary high water mark, because at that level there was no danger and no problem in getting out to Pete's Point. At some point, and the other thing is there were no readings of what the existing road level was in terms of the high water mark back in 1988 or before that. There are, however, a number of readings that have been taken through the years by the DNR or by somebody, and they're in the brief, but basically only seven through the years from 1961 until 1993, only seven readings had been taken of the water levels. All of those were within the 112 range.
Could you identify for me, Council, where in the stipulated facts the 112 ordinary high water mark appears?
The
apparently you contend that was the ordinary high water mark in 1988 when the fill was placed.
We contend, Your Honor, that 112.0 was the pond level that was to have been maintained by the permit. We don't know specifically what the high water mark would have been had it been taken back in 1988. We do know that at 112, and these numbers from 1962 to 1990 that were taken, the seven that were taken, none of those levels ever reached the point where the road would have been underwater. That information comes from Mr. Sontag, the DNR's representative, who filed an affidavit. His affidavit shows that the first water level was taken on July 30th, 1962, and that showed a water level of 112.91. The next one was on July 22nd of 65, 3 years later, at 112.73.
Was that incorporated in the stipulated facts?
I don't think that was in the facts itself. I think those facts came out subsequent to the filing of the action, but they're contained in an affidavit by Mr. Sontag.
But insofar as the stipulation of facts, which is, I think, what everybody is bound to as the factual record in this case, unless it's incorporated into that, why would we even be looking at it?
Well, because there's far more in this case than the stipulated facts. Both sides presented affidavits, Your Honor, which supported their respective positions. We started out with what we thought could be the stipulated issues and some of the stipulated facts. Then each side presented affidavits in support of their respective positions on the motions for summary judgment. One of those affidavits came from Mr. Sontag, the DNR engineer, who then placed in his affidavit these readings that were taken over the period of time from 1962 until 1990. Strangely enough, none of those exceeded 112. The highest is 112.91, and the low was 112.27.
Well, it seems to me that your legal argument here is that the respective rights of the state and your clients are governed by the ordinary high water mark as of the date the fill was placed. Is that a summary of your...
I think that's correct.
Okay. And was there or was there not a disputed issue of fact as to what that ordinary high water mark was on that date?
Oh, absolutely, because our position is that the ordinary high water mark was created because of the controversy that took place in the 1980s because of everybody wanting different water levels.
Okay, if there was such a disputed issue of fact, then why did everybody agree that this case was appropriate for summary judgment?
We didn't agree that the case was appropriate for summary judgment on that issue.
Well, it was your motion, was it not?
One of our motions was that the court, as a matter of law, should have found that the pond level should have been maintained at 112.0. And then we showed the court the permit, and we showed the court the... see, my orange light is on here. We showed the court the permit, and we tried to convince the court that the order required that pond level be maintained. If the pond level had been maintained at 112, there would have been no problem with the rules. But the problem arose in the 1980s, when Mr. Bowers took over as the person who managed the dam. He said, I had no direction. I didn't even know that there was a permit. I didn't even know there was a water level requirement. And the DNR said to him, do whatever you want to do as far as the dam is concerned. And the DNR has supervisory control and authority over the dam. Indeed, the statutes require the DNR to gauge the water levels from time to time, and that wasn't done. Now the waters are being... or the lands are being overflowed, the road is being inundated by water, and Kelly's want to protect the road in order to get out to Pete's Point. And the state comes along and says, you can't do it because we've established this ordinary high water mark, which is now 113.5, excuse me.
Well, can that high water mark be changed again to be 115?
I don't think it can unless there's some sort of a hearing to change the pond level of the dam. There's a requirement under the statutes that if you're going to maintain a pond level in excess of the permitted requirements, that there has to be a whole process under 31.12, I think it is, of the statutes.
And you've cited that in your
31.13.
So suppose that hearing is held and they raise the high water mark and your road is now underwater. We're not passable.
I think if that happened, then either compensation would have had to be accorded to the property owners or some provisions would have had to be included in the permit to allow the people whose roads would be inundated by water to protect them. So I don't think that you can have a hearing and say we're just going to arbitrarily raise the waters so you can't get to your land and not allow them to protect their properties. I think that's the purpose why we have hearings, for the change in the elevations of water backed up by dams. So.
Now, well, that was, just so I understand your argument, looking at that was that you had this 112, and then the state went and they had the ordinary high water mark at 113 something. Are you maintaining they should have had a hearing for that when they set that? They didn't have one, did they?
No, but they should have had a hearing to raise the pond level to a point above the 112.0. That was never done. They just let the dam go by whim or wish of whoever happened to be there at the time.
Well, but the trial court found that there was permit asked for 112, but the order did not specify 112.
That's what they say, and then in the memos, which the DNR passed back and forth, they say that I explained that our procedure would be to do a formal investigation, which may result in a new water level order. That's the memo of October 20th of 1994. Another memo of October 21st of 1994, from Mr. Smith to Mr. Lang of the DNR, saying, don't think we should mess with this until a Kelly case is completed. That is the water level issue. I've told the town several times that it can regulate the water levels as long as they don't violate the permit. Well, if there's internal memos about violating the permit to themselves, how can they represent to the court that we have a permit that doesn't have any water level requirements? They're telling themselves something that's different from what they're telling the court. We think that's improper.
What's the relationship between a benchmark and a high water mark?
The benchmark on the dam was a point from which they took measurements. This benchmark is a brass marker that was put into the right wing wall of the dam. It originally showed the elevation of that benchmark to be 116.25. All the measurements of the water then would be taken from that benchmark. When you change the benchmark to 115.25, you're actually raising the water by 1 foot. My red light's on, Your Honor.
Yeah, you can finish your answer. You may finish your sentence.
So that if you measure down from the benchmark, let's say to a level of 112, and it's 116.25, you're measuring 4.25 feet. If that benchmark is changed to 115.25, you're measuring from the same benchmark, but you're only measuring 3.25 feet down, which makes the water level look like it's a foot higher, and it is. So that benchmark was changed after Mr. Kelly was charged criminally in this case, and before the criminal case was dismissed by somebody. We don't have in our fishing boxes the tools to punch in those numbers, but somebody changed that to 115.25. DNR says they didn't do it. Obviously, the Kellys had no motive to do that. Thank you.
Mr. Weber, could I ask one? Could you state just succinctly, what is the black letter rule that you would like to see come out of this case?
I would like to see, number one, a statement by this court that says that permit for the dam required a maintenance of a pond level at 112.0. I would like to see the court reiterate the proposition that the ordinary high water mark circumscribes the limits of the jurisdiction of the Department of Natural Resources in terms of navigational rights, which I believe is already the law. And thirdly, I'd like to see this court say that the court was wrong in granting summary judgment, that the pond level was not maintained as required, and that we be allowed to put that road back in.
Well, you want summary judgment in your favor. You don't want to go back.
I would like that, Judge, but I think there's an issue on the ordinary high water mark as it existed at the time that the overflow or the roads were put in.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Tinker, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Tinker. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I've been the prosecutor in this case through its long life. This case started when a young man, Peter Kelly, the son of John Kelly, decided that he wanted to build a house up north at his father's land. The initial problem he faced that on a regular, reoccurring basis, this land was an island. There was a logging road that extended out to this peninsula, but because the dam had been held historically at between 112 and 113 during the summer months, the roads were regularly covered with water. Pete Kelly, who hired the Arnotts to lay the fill in the area that we're only talking about one of the fill areas, was 20 feet wide and 200 feet long. And the fill was in the water for the entire length of the 200 road. So although there may have been portions underwater, the fill was placed in navigable water for the full length. During his deposition, he said, well, between 86 when my dad got the land and 88 when I had the fill laid, I was out there about 50 times. And on about half those occasions, the road was covered. The fill was laid. Before he laid it, he thought, well, maybe I should check with the DNR. And he checked with a retired DNR employee, and they said, well, you know, that'd be a lot of red tape. So acting on that, he just hired Arnott Trucking to go and place fill on the road. And that was done, Peter Kelly says, September or October of 88. Toward the end of October of 88, Dorothy Conkle and her...
I take it that that was done at a point where the road was not submerged.
No, they're actually, Peter Kelly in his deposition stated that at the time the fill was laid, there was water across the road. Okay. An affidavit from one of the machinery operators said there was water across portions of the road, and that on the other parts he had to be careful where he put his machinery for fear of going into the water. Mr. John Kelly, who was out there, says there was not water across the road. So on that issue, there was actually a disputed fact. It was discovered by Mrs. Conkle and her husband. They were retired, living on the lake up there, and they regularly canoed around the island. I'll call it an island. To see, there's eagle's nest in the area, blue herons, and ospreys. And they said when the water was high enough, they could canoe around the area. On this day, they're going north, and there's a road where they are usually going. And she testified at the trial that as she sat in the canoe, the fill was up to her shoulder. That's how high the fill had been placed. They wrote a letter to the DNR. The DNR investigated it, but couldn't find where the fill was until the next spring. So the issues, I think, come down to, in broad terms, is first, does the DNR have jurisdiction? Was this water navigable, in fact? And then secondly, if it's navigable, in fact, and there are violations, are there valid defenses to this? The law is longstanding that if water is navigable, in fact, that if you're able on a regular, reoccurring basis to take a craft, even a draft of 3 inches across water, it is navigable, in fact, and the state has jurisdiction. It doesn't have to be a constant condition. It just has to be regular and reoccurring. The very early cases where they were talking about floating logs, they were saying that a period of spring flowage of 4 to 13 days would be a sufficient length of time to create those rights in that water. There is an issue raised in the briefs, the fact that this is private land under the flowage. For the purposes of the hearing, did not dispute that. Mr. Kelly has title to that land. But that is not a unique case. Most of the cases that have been previously decided in this area involve private land. In the DeGaynor case, it was involving a one-mile stream where the DeGaynor Corporation owned both banks and therefore owned the bed of the water. In the Diana Shooting Club, they had lease rights underneath the water where the people wanted to float their boats in to duck hunt. In the Blutt case, we had a situation where the entire lake was owned by private people and it was artificially fed. But in that case, the court still found that the DNR had jurisdiction under Chapter 30 because it was navigable in fact. None of those cases say that it has to be navigable in fact and an ordinary high water mark established. In the Bleck case, there was no ordinary high water mark established. In the Diana Shooting Club case that has the classic language for ordinary high water mark, they determined there was jurisdiction based upon navigability, in fact, and there was no discussion of what the actual ordinary high water mark was. So I don't believe that you need to have both. If we can establish that it's navigable on a regular, reoccurring basis, then the DNR should have jurisdiction.
And that's what the trial judge said, that your opponents testified that there was water there for a considerable period of time, and therefore some of the other arguments that were made here were not necessary because he granted summary judgment on that basis, that of the I would say, partial flooding or partial being for a substantial period of time over each year.
Correct.
Well, counsel, a lot of times up north, as I'm sure you are aware, water levels of lakes are adjusted, you know, seasonally. I think up in Manitowish, for instance, the water level of some lake is adjusted so that the oilers don't have to take out their piers. Now, assuming, let's assume this case, let's assume that I own property that for 6 or 8 months out of the year is dry, and unquestionably is above the ordinary high level, ordinary HW, whatever it is, ordinary high water mark, okay? So it's above the ordinary high water mark. But on occasion, during the other 6 months, somebody is able to flood to change the level of the lake so that, in fact, the water rises and covers my land. Now, I take it as your position that because that has occurred, or at least if it occurs on a regular and recurring basis, I do not have the right to place anything on that land, even though it's above the high water mark, the ordinary high water mark.
Correct. I believe, assuming it's on a regular reoccurring basis, mm-hmm. and not just a sudden, like a flash flood,
mm-hmm.
I believe that you're not allowed to place that fill without a permit. There is provisions where you can obtain a permit to place that fill. You could, another remedy, you could go to the dam operator and say, why is this happening? Oh, that wasn't done here. You could go to the DNR to ask for an investigation to determine what's going on here. This lake was held at variable levels from the very beginning. Even Mr. Kelly's uncle, who started, was the major pusher behind this dam. They would have a winter drawdown. Traditionally, the dam was held at 4 boards during the summer, and then as winter approached, they would draw down the dam. And that was done because in the original design, the banks were going to have metal on them. But because they decided not to go with the metal protection for the bank, they were drawing down the water to avoid erosion. And because that was the case, that goes against an argument that the permit required that the pond level be held constantly at 112. One of the big issues, excuse me.
Let me just ask you this. This is a case where the state is seeking forfeiture, right?
Correct. Forfeiture and injunctive relief.
Ah. The injunction is what? Not to do it again?
Removal of the fill.
Removal of fill. Has the fill been removed?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Initially, the Kelly's had some of the fill removed. The DNR believed that it hadn't all been removed.
So the fill is gone, the injunction is not relevant.
Correct.
So we're into the money damages, which has been stipulated at $3,000.
Correct.
At least agreed upon. Okay. So if the state wins this case, you get $3,000.
Correct.
Now, if the Kellys want to put in a road, can they go get a permit?
They can seek a permit under...
Seek a permit.
Correct.
Okay.
Under two grounds. One would be a permit asking to place fill on the bed of navigable waters. There is also a provision for placement for fording across the stream.
Okay. So, and if the state, so Kelly still have an opportunity to fill. If the state should lose and the Kellys don't have to pay the state $3,000, does that mean they can fill this land, or they still have to get a permit?
Well, I'm sure it would be argued that they should still seek a permit, Chief Justice. It all depends on how your decision is worded.
Well, now you heard what opposing counsel said in response to Justice Prosser, that the permit requires maintenance of the level at 112, and that the high water mark circumscribes the limits of the jurisdiction of navigable rights. You agree with that as a holding in this case?
No. On the initial holding with regard to the permit requiring 112, at the time of the summary judgment, we presented opinion testimony from various DNR people saying that the permit suggested a level of 112. They were going to try to hold it at 112, but it was not required.
Is 112 a high watermark?
No, that would be the level where the pond would be held at. And
so what would the high watermark be if the level of the pond was 112?
Well, we have nothing in the record to show that. What we do know that when the pond is held at between 12.5 and 13, then we get an ordinary high water mark of 13.5. But it really all depends upon the terrain in the area. If this is a perfect bowl, if this was a perfect bowl with water flowing into it, we could kind of do the calculus to figure, but the terrain varies. There was no establishment at the summary judgment stage of what the ordinary high would be if the pond was kept at 112.
Okay. Now, the ordinary high water mark, does that relate to this particular property?
Yes, it was taken out at that property. They started at the dam, figured out what the level of the water was, and then assumed the water level was out the same out at the property, and then they go out and look for signs of where the water has constantly been held. For example, one of the signs they found here, along the bank there were jack pines. Jack pines, when they grow, when their roots hit water, they grow horizontally. So that gives you an indication of where the long-term water level is. These jack pines leveled out at 113.5.
At the Kelly's property?
Yes, near the Kelly's property.
So your position is that it's 113.5 is the ordinary high water mark at the Kelly's property?
That's correct. And the defense expert, Mr. Wiley, estimated it to be 113.
Okay. And if it was 113 to 113.5, he has to fill. Is that the point?
Correct.
To get the road in?
Right. Correct.
And that's what you're objecting to?
Yes. Our main objection is placing fill on the bed of navigable waters. And in terms of whether or not the permit required 112 or did not, at the summary judgment stage, we offered examples of prior dam permits ordered by the Public Service Commission. These were ordered by the Public Service Commission. We presented the trial court with six dam permits, two of them from the same year, 1959, where the maximum and minimums were set forth in the findings of facts and then repeated in the order in the permit. So their basis for believing that if it's not in the permit or the order, it's not mandatory is based on those.
Well, isn't the argument of counsel, of your opposing counsel, twofold? Number one, that, primarily, that he has the right to place fill on land that is above the ordinary high water mark. And number two, this was above the ordinary high water mark.
The first part, clearly he does have the right to place fill above the ordinary high water mark in the upland. We're not disputing that. But we believe that this was, in fact, below the ordinary high water mark, and it was also in navigable waters.
So, he believes that it wasn't, right? That it was above the ordinary high water mark. Isn't that his argument?
Yes, that's what he's claiming.
And at summary judgment, the trial court said that it was below the ordinary high water mark?
That's correct. And there was no, what was presented was that it was below it was stipulated that fill was placed below the ordinary high water mark as determined at 1990. Although the defense, I don't believe, presented any evidence disputing that it would have been something different in 1988.
Now that's the material your opposing counsel, just to pick up on this, said that he thought that the court was wrong in granting summary judgment because that issue that you're talking about, counsel, was still in, that was a dispute about just exactly what you're talking about now.
Well,
that was in dispute.
Let's look at the stipulation. Okay.
Well, it was stipulated.
It's 142 in the appendix. And I think we're talking about number 7, but I wouldn't bet on it. Is that what you're talking about? Fill material was placed in the long fill area at some spots below what the DNR calculated on June 25, 1990 to be the ordinary high water mark.
That's correct, and then the numbers are up in paragraph three.
That's right.
That's correct.
Well, it says, although the parties disagree by distance of 1 foot as the correct benchmark height, if we are to assume the dam benchmark height of 115 as contended by the DNR, the ordinary high water mark would be at 113.50. Or assuming the benchmark height of 116 as calculated defendants, the ordinary high mark would be 114.50.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, if the ordinary high mark is 114, is he filling below the high water mark?
Yes, because there are diagrams presented in support of the motion for summary judgment by Engineer Sontag where he has drawn the bed, he has drawn in levels of where they found the fill, and it shows that some of the fill went below even 111. So clearly it was below 114.
Well, you've got a stipulation that this fill below your calculation, the DNR, which is 115.25. Is there a stipulation that it's below, that there was fill below 114.50, which is his calculation?
Yes, if the what they're, the 114.50 is actually the same site, is actually the same line, it's just we're using a different benchmark. So that goes back to our argument about what the benchmark represents.
Yes. All
but
right.
If we were to go out to the property and draw a line on the bank at 113.5 under the state's scheme or 114.5 under the defendant's scheme, they'd be the same line. It's just we're starting with a different reference point.
Well, do you view then that the stipulated fact number 7 finishes this case?
No, I believe, I hope what finishes this case is the fact that it was navigable in fact.
I'm confused. 15 minutes ago you said that if I had property that was above the ordinary high water mark, but for whatever reason, on a recurring basis, water from another lake came in and made it navigable, I could not build on that because it was navigable. Isn't that
correct? If it's on a regular reoccurring basis.
And then about 2 minutes ago, you answered my question saying that you don't contest his right to place fill on land that is above the ordinary high water mark. That's totally.
There could be a set of facts where that would be.
Does the riparian owner have a right to put fill on a piece of land that is above the ordinary high water mark if, on a regular recurring basis, that area becomes navigable?
I will now have to change my earlier answer and say no, because I believe if it becomes navigable, in fact, on a regular basis, prior to an ordinary high water mark being established so that it's still above the ordinary high, I think they can't because it's navigable in fact and subject to 30.12.
So then the issue really is whether or not a riparian owner has a right to put fill on property that is above the ordinary high water mark if, in fact, that property at times, on a regular and recurring basis, is navigable.
Correct.
Isn't the problem here that we're kind of mushing together the law about navigability and the law about ordinary high water mark, and that basically, as I read these cases anyway, if you've got a navigable body of water, state jurisdiction to regulate is established, and you only get to the analysis of where the ordinary high water mark is if you've got non-navigable water, right?
Correct. I agree. And the example from this case is that the longest part of the fill where the trial court entered judgment was navigable, in fact. A middle fill area, parts of that were below the ordinary high, But because there had been a question raised, the judge felt that there might be a material issue of fact on that. And since we hadn't shown it navigable in fact, he declined to enter a summary judgment.
He confined his ruling, as did the Court of Appeals, to that portion of this case which concerns what there was a factual finding of navigability in fact.
That's correct. That's correct.
So this whole discussion about where the ordinary high watermark is or isn't is irrelevant.
I believe it is, and that ties into Justice Wilcox's question about, well, how could the trial court have granted summary judgment if the ordinary high was still in dispute? And the reason is that once you've established that the water is navigable in fact, we've established jurisdiction and there is a violation. So you don't even have to reach the ordinary high watermark question. And that's how the court, and I would urge the court to accept the Court of Appeals' reasoning.
Well, now, you got this pond. You could really, let's assume that they can open up the dam and they can, or close it, whichever way this one will go, and flood a yard all the way up to a house, I mean, theoretically. And then the yard becomes navigable. And they do that regularly. Is that okay? Or is that a taking?
If, assuming they don't have easement rights, that could very well be a taking.
Assuming the DNR doesn't have easement, or the state doesn't have easement rights.
Yeah, in this, yes, Judge. In that, Justice, in this case, it would be the town.
Okay.
If the town does not have easement, flowage easement rights, that could very well be a taking.
Well, then why isn't that their argument here? That what you have is this taking because you're flooding it regularly. And at one point, there was a road there. Not his road, their road.
Well, in fact, they have argued that there's a taking. I don't believe that there is a taking, but even if we go beyond. I don't believe there was a taking because they have not been deprived of the entire use of that property. And the entire use is to be measured by, under the just case, is to be determined by its natural state. The next thing is, well, even if there is a taking, what is the remedy? The Court of Appeals held that the remedy was compensation. And I think the cases, for the most part, say that if there's a governmental taking, the remedy is compensation, not the ability to ignore the regulations.
You comply. You think they'd have to bring a suit against you for taking if that's what they want?
Correct. Either the state or the town.
Not fill in the land.
That's correct. They should have either contacted the town to adjust, have the dam level adjusted, or gotten a permit, or sought to have the lake level lowered officially.
So if you were writing this opinion, what would you write?
I would write that I believe that because the area was navigable, in fact, on a regular reoccurring basis, the state had jurisdiction, and Section 3012 and 3015 were violated, that the dam permit stated that they would try to, that a level of 112 would try to be held, but it was not a required level, that there was no taking in this case. There were no other constitutional violations, such as it's not an excessive fine. In this case, it does not shock the conscience. It was only double the amount of the of how much they paid to place the fill. I guess, in broad terms, there are no constitutional violations.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Tinker? Given the 1958 permit, if I were put in charge of controlling the dam, and you were my legal advisor, and I asked you, I see this reference to 112 feet, how high can I raise the pond level? What would you say?
I would say that you're allowed to maintain the pond level so that the water does not rise above the DNR's established ordinary high water mark of 113.5. unless you've obtained Floyd's easements for the entire area.
But suppose suppose I took over the dam before you established that high water mark, ordinary high water mark.
Correct.
What would you have said then?
Well, in the first few years, the dam is really finding its equilibrium. I would have advised them that I would have told them to hold it at the level that the people on the lake wanted it held at, unless it was causing major problems.
Well, now, I have pressure to raise the level of the lake. There's some important people who want the lake raised. Can I do that?
Assuming there has not been an ordinary high water mark established, then I think you can, subject to the ability of the dam to hold that. And also, you do face the possibility, as the water goes up, people are losing their land.
Well, that's the point here. It seems to me, if this 112 feet doesn't really mean anything, there can be ever greater encroachments on private land. And with those encroachments, there will be navigability in fact. And so the more flagrant the violations, seems to me, the more control you have over private land. Why is that wrong?
What was the last part of the question, Justice?
The more in excess of 112 feet in this case, the more jurisdiction you have.
That's correct. And that flows naturally from the increased level. And that's the case law says that once it increases, those rights accrue immediately. So that is a concern. But what the system has in place to deal with that is that the riparian owners, if it gets too high, can complain. In this case, there were no complaints prior to Mr. Kelly placing the fill. The complaints that were discussed by Mr. Weber were complaints from the riparians that the winter drawdown was going too low. They didn't want it drawn down as low. They repaired the dam in 1993 and drew the lake all the way down and then reestablished a regimen of holding it at about 112 and a half and then drawing it down a couple boards in the winter. The riparians were complaining that they were drawing the water down too low in the winter. So the restraints on an ever-increasing level is the riparians' ability, in this case where it's not a mandated level, they can complain to the town board, they could complain to the DNR, they could seek a formalized minimum and maximum for the lake level. The DNR attorney in his affidavit stated that if they had received complaints, they would have established the 3102 hearing to establish a minimum and maximum. So that is a possible threat, but the system has some remedies in place to try to avoid that problem where it causes problems.
Are there any conditions under which the Kellys did not need a permit? What I'm trying to get at is, regardless of high water mark, pond level, etc., because it's navigable, did they need a permit, therefore in violation?
I believe they needed a permit, correct.
Are there any conditions where they didn't need a permit in this case?
Under these facts, assuming it was flooded on a regular reoccurring basis, I think they would have needed a permit. I can't think of a set of facts where they would not.
Even if you were wrong in flooding it regularly?
Correct. I think if we, assuming the trial judge addressed this as well, assuming that the dam was impermissibly held too high, they had a series, there's no exception in 3012 for that removes the permitting requirement. There are a number of things they could have done. They could have gone to the DNR and asked them to enforce the 112 lake level, or they could have complained to the DNR, and the DNR could have done an investigation.
But it wasn't, no self-help. That's your position.
Correct.
Question. Mr. Tinker, your position, I believe anyway, is that the public trust doctrine applies to all waters that are navigable. And it seems to me that your opponent's position is that the public trust doctrine applies only to waters that are both navigable and within the ordinary high water mark. I think that's how I see it coming down.
Correct.
Now, in Trudeau, State versus Trudeau, which is a 1987 case, we talked a lot about this because we were referring to, I think it was a motel that was built, at least allegedly built within the ordinary high water mark. And we cited specifically to Illinois Steel versus Villat. And there we said, the tightest of beds of all lakes and ponds and of rivers navigable, in fact, as well, up to the line of ordinary high water mark become vested in the state. Now, how do you get around language like that? That seems to be very supportive of your opponent's position.
Because there are a number of ways of determining whether or not there is jurisdiction. In those situations where it's swamp or it's wetlands, where it's clearly not navigable, the state still has an interest in those areas below the ordinary high water mark. If we're in a situation where it's clearly navigable, then we don't even get to the ordinary high water mark. And in this case, I believe we actually established that the fill was placed below the ordinary high
water. Well, if you did, then you're okay.
Correct.
But it seems to be the important question of law is the one that I've referred to.
I don't believe any of the cases that are dealing with whether a particular area is navigable waters, I don't remember any of them mandating a finding of ordinary high water mark. The Bleck case stated that once we determine it's navigable, in fact, the discussion over jurisdiction ends. And that's the situation. There are cases where they were navigable, in fact, and you didn't have to determine the ordinary high.
I don't think in Bleck we had to determine OHWM, did we?
That's correct. You didn't need to get there.
And that's your position, even if you have unlawfully made this water navigable.
That's correct.
Because then you have to fight that on a different ground.
Yes.
Not on a permanent ground. That's your position.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tinker. Mr. Weber.
Just a few things. We seem to be going around in circles here because the 113.5 high water mark, which was established 1.5, almost 2 years after the fill was placed, was established because of the manner in which the dam was being operated. So we didn't have an ordinary high water mark at the time the fill was placed. If we take the 114.5, which was discussed as the ordinary high water mark, assuming the elevation at the benchmark was 115.25 has changed, we've got water that is 2.5 feet above that which was allowed by the permit, or 30 inches above that which is allowed by the permit. So what council apparently is saying to the court is that we can simply do whatever we want by way of regulating this dam. We can leave the boards in. We get water coming through because of high rains. We get water coming through because of spring thaws, and we leave the boards in the dam at any level we want. And if we flood out my backyard or my front yard or up to my windows, suddenly the state has jurisdiction over my land, and I have no remedy other than to say, well, maybe I can, at some point along the line, start an action for inverse condemnation. I think that's why the cases all say that once you establish a high water mark, that is the extent of the state's jurisdiction insofar as navigation is concerned. Now, admittedly, there are situations, and we all know up north where you've got flowages where water will come in and inundate people's properties, but then the water recedes. And certainly in the spring that happens, certainly at times when we have heavy rains that happens. I can remember up at Phillips, Wisconsin, my folks had a cottage on the Musser Flowage. The water would get so high that it would go over the road below the dam, and we couldn't get out from time to time. And that was sort of a regularly reoccurring condition. Does that mean that because that happens, that suddenly the state has acquired jurisdiction over my private property? I think that would be curious law if that, in fact, were the case.
What about the regulatory remedies that Mr. Tinker mentioned?
I don't think, Your Honor, that the state has any regulatory authority that extends beyond the established ordinary high water mark. And I think by necessity that has to be the law, because the ordinary high water mark is set there for a reason. And the cases, such as the Trudeau case, all say that we have distinguished between state-owned lake bed and the uplands capable of private ownership. And they define the word uplands as lands bordering bodies of water but above the high water mark. And they go on to say the public interest in and the title to the navigable waters in the state attaches to more than the open and perpetually navigable waters contained in lakes, rivers, and streams. It extends to areas covered with aquatic vegetation within the ordinary high water mark of the body of water.
Right, that's a legal analysis that applies to non-navigable waters. But here we have a concession, apparently, that this was navigable under the test in the Gainer. And once that's established, that's the end of the...
We don't acknowledge at all, that when those roads were there prior to the 80s and in the early part of the 80s, that water went over the road. There's a green map, it's Exhibit 5, which is in the record, that shows aerial photographs. It was a geological survey map. And the DNR person who testified in this case on a deposition said it's one of the most accurate maps that you can get short of an actual on-ground survey. And that geological map showed this property back in 1969 and again checked in 1971. It showed that road clearly on that geological survey map extending out to Pete's Point.
So you do not concede navigability according to this?
We do not concede navigability of this road prior to the middle 80s. That is, there was no problem with getting out to Pete's Point prior to the middle 80s when all this business about the dam arose and people said, we want higher water.
Okay, do you concede navigability as of the time the fill was placed?
We concede that at the time the fill was put in is because the water kept coming up and then going down. And we said, now we've got to do something to protect our roads.
Okay.
So how do you do that? You put the fill in, and in some places you put a foot in, and in some places as much as a foot and a half.
I understand that, but was there a concession in the trial court that at the time the fill was placed, this was a navigable body of water under the DeGainer test in 3012 of the statutes?
Well, we acknowledge that that Lake Killarney, which was backed up by the dam, was
the access road. Because we're talking about the access road, right? And whether it was navigable.
We acknowledge that at times the water would come up over the road. And at times it would go down, depending upon how the dam was being operated or not operated. So that, and that's the reason why the fill was placed in, because he'd go out there, one day he'd go out and he could drive out to Pete's Point, it'd be fine. And then a week later he'd go out and there'd be water in some spots on the road. So
I guess I'm trying to get a handle on why, if there were so many disputed issues of fact as to the two critical legal issues in this case, navigability and ordinary high water mark, everybody agreed that this was a summary judgment case. I don't understand that.
Well, we thought it was a summary judgment case in that it was clear that the dam permit was being violated, because clearly the water was allowed to go well over the requirement of the permit. We were looking for the court to say that permit required the pond level to be maintained at 112.0.
And that authorizes a self-help remedy as opposed to a regulatory remedy? In other words, the property owner has that self-help available instead of going to the agency and saying, do something about this?
Sure.
Under the ordinary systems there?
Sure, we thought that if if the pond was to be maintained at a higher level, then there'd be a hearing, like the statute requires. We'd be, have a chance to be heard at the hearing. And there'd be a, if they want to establish a new water level, then provisions could be made in the permit to allow for people that own property to protect themselves. Like, they could say, well, fine, you can put in a foot and a half of fill or whatever it might take to protect yourself. But there was no hearing here on the level of that water. The permit stands, and we were asking the court to say that the water pond should remain at 112 as required by the permit. The court said the permit didn't require a ponding level of water.
Your client could have initiated that process, correct?
Yes.
Oh, and did not. Could have initiated that process and said, hey, look, you're flooding my road. I can't get out to Pete's Point. I want a hearing.
Oh, I don't know that we would. I think the dam is owned and operated by the town. And if the town wished to modify the permit, they would have to seek a hearing before the DNR, and then they would have a hearing to raise or lower the level. We don't own the dam. The town owns the dam. The DNR is supposed to supervise the water levels and gauge the water levels. They left that up to the town.
Did your client have the right to seek the initiation of such a process, a challenge to the way the dam was being managed?
I don't know, Judge. I can't tell you that. I assume they could have... I don't know. I don't know, but I assume the operator of the dam, if he wasn't operating pursuant to the permit and wanted the levels higher, the Lake Association people out there were complaining that they wanted more water in the lake for whatever reason. There's stumps and things like that. They want them covered up, and they just allowed it to happen. Mr. Bowers, who operated that dam for 10 years in the 80s and the 90s, said he didn't even know there was a permit. He said, I just left the boards in there, and if the water got too high, I was coming over the piers, and at times it was coming over by 30 inches. Then I pulled some boards out. And obviously you could establish a water, ordinary high water mark pretty quickly. If, as Mr. Lang says, it only takes 6 months to establish an ordinary high water mark, which was done a year and a half or more after the fill was placed.
Thank you
very much.
Mr. Weber. Thank you, Tinker. That concludes our hearing in 99-1066 State versus Kelly, and that concludes our February cases. We are adjourned to February.
Thank you.